Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome.
Welcome back to One Broken Mom. You're about ready to listen to the second half of my interview with Craig Miller, author, speaker, and advocate for suicide prevention. Now, I know something that maybe my listeners don't know. You talked about your family a little bit, but your mom just died by suicide just recently, like just a few months ago. How does that strike you as a person, you know, a few years into your awareness, your development, your growth, you know, I mean, how was that to go through that?
There's a lot to that story, to that piece. So my, we obviously had a difficult, a rough relationship growing up and all of that. She wasn't a bad person. She wasn't, intentionally abusive or anything. She scared the hell out of me a lot. But she never did anything about her mental health issues and things that she went on. So then I knew she was unhealthy for me, and not in a really bad way. It's just like, if she was my neighbor, I wouldn't have a relationship with her. She makes me feel bad about who I am, and everything I do somehow hurts her, and I'm made well aware of how much it hurts her and, you know, everything. So I really distanced myself from her about 16 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was like, I can't do it anymore. I just can't do it. And then I wrote my book 6 or 7 years ago, whatever it was. And in telling my story, I had to include her. She's my mom, and she was a big part of the story. And I sent her an email and said, hey, I wrote a book. It's available. I wanted you to hear it from me, not from anyone else. It includes you, your husband, but more than anything, I talked about me. And, kind of going on like the type of person she was to me, I heard nothing back from her for months. And I knew from my brothers that she had read it. And Christmas came, and she sent my daughters Christmas cards and a little gift. So I wrote her an email. I said, hey, thank you for the Christmas cards. We got them, blah, blah, blah. And she wrote back. In my mind, this is, my mother has read my book, learned for the first time. No one knew, by the way, that I was sexually abused until I wrote my book. And no one knew the extent of the mental health issues I had and things like that. So it was a lot, you know, imagine on a mother's side, taking that and listening to reading it and learning all this stuff. So I said that, you know, thanks for the cards. And she wrote back, the gifts were from me and my husband. If you can't thank my husband, don't thank me. That was her response to learning all this stuff about me. So mm-hmm. to me, it was like, okay, that's confirmation. That's right. That's why we don't have a relationship. Everything's good. And then through the years, I mean, this is rough, but through my work in suicide prevention, I mean, I was getting a lot of attention, still do, I guess, in some regards, but so like news things where I'm talking about my life and it's on Facebook and my mother's reading it and she's sending me leaving me these voicemails about how I hurt her so badly and you know, how could I say these things about her and stuff? And I never got on and said anything that wasn't true. And I never gave an opinion. I just said what happened. I gave the facts mm-hmm. of what happened. Whatever comes out of that is what comes out of that. So that you can imagine it got very, very intense. And I had gotten some voicemails from her of different articles that were posted online that she had read or seen. And, told me, you know, her last voicemail to me was that I'm only doing this for fame and pity. And yeah, it was pretty significant. So then I'm involved in suicide prevention for the last 7 years on a national level, speaking at conferences, keynoting things, state and national stuff, universities, the whole thing, suicide prevention advocate, and my mother dies by suicide. That was, wow. Wow, that was big. That was very, very big. And the hardest part about it for me was that she, until that point, she openly spoke to everyone she could about the pain I caused her and how upset she was that we didn't have a relationship. And I've been told by a couple people in the family that I was the main factor in me being public about our story was the main factor behind where she was and where it went. So that was difficult for me, you know. I'm not absorbing that. I'm not going to take that. I fully understand that when someone's in a suicidal state of mind, they are not thinking clearly. They're irrational. So I'm not accepting that I drove her to suicide by talking about my story.
Right.
There's no way I'm picking that on, but it still sucked really badly. And I think the suicide prevention community, the people who knew me were like, holy shit, is this guy ever going to come back from this? What happened? Right. Like, this guy is on the front lines of suicide prevention and his mother just died by suicide. So that kind of like took everyone back, and the outpouring of support and condolences was amazing. And then as soon as that ended, it was like everyone left me alone. Like, you know, no one wanted to, like, is he okay? They didn't want to ask me to be included in anything. They just kind of like, what's going on? So I think people were really surprised that I was okay. And I can tell you that through the last 7 years that I've been doing suicide prevention and speaking, I do have a day job, and that's intentional. I had up till now always said, I don't want to do this full time. I don't want to make a career out of it. You saw me, my eyes are filling up speaking about this story. That's not because it's painful for me, because it's so deeply embedded, like it's there. And I'm touching a part of myself that is very, very deep. And I usually tear up because I feel it's beautiful, which is odd for some people to believe, but it's true. I feel it's so beautiful. It makes me tear up. That I've lived this stuff and I'm here and I can talk about it. My God, how amazing is this, right? So do I want to expose myself to that continuously? I don't think so. I don't think it's too taxing, right? So I always kind of like rode the line. I'd go back to work. I'd go and fly out somewhere and speak for a few days and come back to work and put another hat on and go about my life. My mother's suicide actually flipped me to the other side and said, no, this is what I want to do.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know why. I think it was like shit, we just needs to change. This needs to stop. Like, what am I doing? If I have it in my capacity to communicate the value in life and what we have and help people who are in a crisis think differently, how in the hell could I ever say no to that? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of shifted for me, and I've now taken on a lot more responsibility in the suicide prevention field and mental health and wellness. But I think the wellness side is not more important to me, but it's where I'm focusing a lot more of my energy, is that pre-prevention.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, it's, I sympathize with that a bit, and empathize with that in the sense that, you know, when you do decide to become an advocate of something like this and you have to speak about our experiences and our traumas, there can be casualties to it in our family and our relationships. I mean, you know, you wouldn't be speaking out and being an advocate for childhood traumas if you didn't have a few. You know, just, I mean, who's going to listen to the perfect person who had a perfect life and have you tell me how to, like, what my experiences were? Yeah. And so, you know, I know for myself that, and I had talked about this at the beginning of last season, that, you know, it's hard when you know, you have to do this, right? Like, there's this pull that you can't stop because it's the right thing to do for other people. And then you also know that when you do this, there's going to be pain down the road for it, that some people are not going to get it, right? And you kind of have to go in with that that idea of, like, I know this is going to hurt people that are hurt people. Mm-hmm. And, but I can't just... you know, and in this, and it sounds, and I, and some of us that have dealt with this, we have to make sure that we're not calling ourselves selfish or self-centered, because those are words people told us when we chose, when we were forced to choose them over ourselves. Right. And that happens when you have emotionally immature people around you, especially when they're the adults that are supposed to be taking care of you. And so you have to, you know, remind yourself, you know, you're not being selfish. You're not being egotistical. You're not doing it for fame. You're not doing it for any of this stuff. You're making a choice. Not everyone's going to be happy with it, but there's so much good benefit. I can't stop. I can't be worried about too many eggshells being broken in order to do something that, that can actually have a positive influence. Because there is something about the fact that if you, it, there are people that don't do anything, they never have that. My son calls it the third person view. We were sitting here talking, he's 17 years old. We had an amazing conversation the other night where, you know, his brain is going through the changes of adolescent brain development. He's like, God, I just realized that I now have a third person view. I can actually see my feelings.
Wow. That's insightful. That's awesome.
It is. It is. And I was just like, oh shit. Like, you know, oh my God, you know, you never know. Right. Until it comes on. And some people never get that, right. Yeah. They never develop that mindfulness of seeing, like, I see that I exist in two planes. I see the logical part that you talked about, and I see my emotional part. And, you know, I helped him the other night. I said, let's, you know, let's name him. I said, you have a sentinel in there that's trying to keep you alive. It's the one out looking for danger. And so anytime it sees danger, it's going to just fire off. And he goes, yeah. He goes, I realize that sometimes my sentinel's speaking for me. And then he named his other part the thinker. And so then we had this conversation. That's now we had developed language, right? Yeah, like, okay, cool. Now we got words to use here, right? But you know, some people never see that there's a sentinel and there's a thinker,
right?
You know,
right.
and that there's them looking at both of those things, wondering which one should I be listening to and which one do I need? How do I solve my sentinel's issues and concerns and their on guardness? And you know, what part of my thinker is really my thinker, or is it my sentinel acting like a thinker? You know, this whole depth of it,
right.
So complex. And you have to see sometimes that some people don't ever get that. And you can't. And those are the ones that you're just like, listen, I'm going to hold a healthy boundary with you, you know? Bless. And, you know, you probably knew that you couldn't sit down with your mom and have a conversation before you wrote a book. Otherwise it probably would have happened. And I had to sit there and think about that myself. Like, I'm not going to get the satisfaction out of a discussion because I know this person is never going to be able to see it from the angles that they need to see and not be offended by it and not take this as a criticism or a judgment of who they are as a person, because they are who they are because of their own experiences.
Exactly.
And you have to kind of like brace yourself for that rejection that you're going to get, or visceral rejection or criticisms or anger or any of that stuff. And you just kind of have to steel yourself up to that. And like, I know it's coming, but I have to do this because I have to stop protecting myself against their responses and their reactions anymore.
Yeah, exactly. No. For me, it was like, I wouldn't even expose myself to any of that. And this is, I think, really key to anyone who's struggling with suicide or attempted or anything like that. I get asked a lot, like, what's your advice to someone who's suicidal? You need to make yourself the number one priority in all the world. That's what I did, right? I'm not saying that's what you need to do. That's an advice thing, right? Take it. Mm-hmm. I don't know what people need to do. What I needed to do was make myself the number one priority, not my job, not my family, not my mother, not my relationships, nothing, no one, nothing, me, my wellness. That has to come first. And that is what drove me to be like, you know what? All this other shit that's overwhelming is really irrelevant. And it can fall, and it's okay. This is what's important, because without this, without me, I won't be able to get back to any of that stuff ever, right? So I made myself the number one priority. And in doing that, I realized that I don't have to sit down with my mother because she's my mother, quote unquote mother. She's another person on the planet. She's another human being who doesn't make me feel good about myself. I have no responsibility to them when I'm in a state that I'm ready to die. I don't owe them anything. This is me right now. And that's a hard thing to say, to feel, you know, make yourself that priority, but you got to do it. I had to do it anyways. And in doing it, I completely detached myself. And if there is, you know, residual effects in the wake of me finding my wellness, I can't allow myself to feel responsible for that, because I did nothing slanderous, right? I never sat down, I never sat on stage and said, my mother is X kind of person. My mother is this. And I never influenced anyone. I just told what happened, mm-hmm. right? That's all I did. And that's all I do. It's not my responsibility to tell other people's stories. I'm telling my story. And in my story, it includes this experience. And in this experience, it includes that person. And this is what they said and did. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's okay. I can do that. I can do that. And I can allow myself to not feel bad about that. So having to like go for me in my life, having to sit down with her and get the permission or clearance to go forward and tell my story, like you said, never would have happened, never. And it was totally unnecessary on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know one of the things that I, you know, in the last several years, mostly in the last couple of years since I, you know, picked up the pulpit here and the microphone and started to do this, it creates in me one of my strong feelings, no shame in admitting this, is anger. You know, I ended up developing into, although you wouldn't even see it, you didn't see an angry, you know, teenage girl. You saw a very compliant, very patient, you know. But inside it was just like, man, I just want to punch walls. And sometimes I did. I just punched walls. I just wanted to like fight against everything. So I fought out where I could because I couldn't protect myself all the time. And so my response is like, I'll get, you know, from people that want to reframe your existence for you. Oh, I know that that's what you said happened, but actually this is what was really going on. And it's like, man, don't even start to tell me what my life is because it fits your narrative.
Right.
Or you want to rewrite my history because you're uncomfortable with my history that I'm telling and sharing right now.
Right.
And then it just pisses me off. And I'm just like, man, talk about just like, I'm gonna close a few more doors here, you know, cut myself off from, you know, and then you just kind of have to, you do have to do that. But it is kind of this thing that, of kind of like, I have to expect it. So I see it and I'm like, I understand why this person feels like they need to retell me my history, where it comes from. I don't have to accept it. Yeah. Making themselves feel better. Or they're trying to protect other people in this case, you know, trying to protect my mom and whatever. It's like, I don't, you know, I get it. Like, and I can't say that enough. Like, you know, I understand, you know, your mom was hurt too, right?
Yeah,
like,
right,
you know,
right.
She didn't grow up with the perfect family, I'm sure.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. She had a lot of issues herself and a lot of issues growing up on top of it where, she undiagnosed, untreated. I mean, she went through her life just trying to manage it herself and managing it with alcohol. And I mean, she would have these emotional outbursts where one minute she would be very loving and kind and telling me these sweet things about myself and made me feel safe. And then that night, she would literally get so angry. She'd walk through, I kind of refer to it as like satisfying her anger engine. She would walk through the kitchen and open the cabinets and take one glass at a time and smash against the wall and just keep going.
Wow.
I mean, literally.
That's
terrifying. Yeah, there was a lot of instances through the years to like 12 years old and younger where our house was like unrecognizable, like tornado. I mean, literally furniture broke and the ceiling broke out, crazy stuff. So there was, and it was like, but I had like, again, I had the wherewithal to be like, this is not right. I know this is not right. You know, I just knew it. So, she had a lot of things going on with her that she didn't treat. And she refused to really acknowledge them, I think was the hardest part.
Yeah.
You know, I think she probably could have done well and gotten things treated if she had sat down and kind of reflected on herself. But she lived a life where everything negative was someone else's fault.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how could you do this to me? Why would you do that? Why would you say that? And, you know, it was really, really unfortunate. So
I think that, you know, listening to you, you know, talking with some other people and then just being reflective on my own experiences too. I think that there's a trauma that happens when you are out of some emotional alignment with your own family, like significantly. When you have, as a young child, like I said, I resonate so much with you. I hope once the pandemic stuff is done, you and I get to actually be in same rooms together.
Yeah.
you know, because we could just do this for hours. But I think that there is this, you know, part of my own experience, I believe, was just feeling like I could see all that too at a young age. And mm-hmm. I was managing and growing up so fast around a bunch of children. And that's what made me valuable to the family, to my mother in particular, is because I was so mature for my age. But there's a trauma of where you're like, dude, am I the wrong one here? Like, am I the crazy one here? Because I can see this and no one else can fucking see and no one else yeah. understands. And I can't even talk to you, like, you know, whatever those reasons are. And there's a trauma there. Like this inability to, you know, emotionally connect with your own family because you see things so differently than they do because, again, emotional immaturity, you know, having that locus of control, right? And they think mm-hmm. the locus of control, internal or external, is also something that's genetic. And how weird it is to be born in a family with one thing where you're like, well, who the hell did I get this from? Like, how did I get imbued with this at such a small age? Yeah. Like, it came out this way, and yet no one else around me seems to have it. Who had it? Like, where did it, you know?
Right, right.
You know, that again, the nature and nurture, because there is, like, there's a lot of us, I believe that there is that sense of trauma that comes from that. Because I look at my younger brothers, you know, and my biological brother handled life totally different, handled the experiences totally different. I don't believe he has that sense of that third person view of his yeah. life. I talked to him and I had to stop talking to him too, because it was like, I can't make you see the world that right. way.
Right.
You know, and it's hard.
Yeah. You know? And it's also draining when you're trying so hard to convince someone and who doesn't want to see it or can't see it. For me, I just have to separate it.
Yep. Yeah.
I'll do what I can for the people who want it.
Yep, right. Totally. And, you know, and that's why I talk on the show about, you know, cutting off. You have to, mm-hmm. you know, you do have to do that, because there is a point of diminishing returns.
Exactly.
You know, on
exactly.
that. And your own energy tanks are worth keeping filled.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
Yeah. Man, you know, so you've talked a lot about some of these things that you've shared, like with the mental health community and some of these real basics that are, you know, kind of in there. You know, what else do you think that needs to change? You know, I think about when you were telling me your story about, you know, it as a teenager, you know, I just wanted to tell you, like, forgive yourself for not addressing your own issues back then. The reality is that how to address issues wasn't as well known then as it was today, even for right. clinicians and, you know, therapists and psychologists and psychiatrists back in the day. So what do you think, you know, this insight that you're bringing in, I mean, we've talked a little bit about storytelling and, you know, this resiliency, what else is there?
That's key. To me, that's key, is in the suicide prevention field, the realm of suicide prevention, I think what's most important, what needs to be continue to be brought to the table is lived experience. It's only recently in the last handful of years that lived experience, people who've been there and hit the bottom and come back and survived and found their way out and are living a managing their life right now, that to me is incredibly valuable. And that's like, I talked about the heart and mind. It's the same comparison with suicide prevention in the field. The field itself right now is very, very heavily weighted on the science, the trust, the brain, the facts, the statistics in the studies, and the evidence-based research that we follow. And that's great. We need it. We have to have that. But that isn't the only thing that suicide is about to me. Suicide doesn't only happen in our minds. It happens in our hearts. And for me, suicide, my mind is what tried to kill me for as long as it did, and still struggle with suicidal thoughts today. That exists in my mind. It's my heart that kept me alive. It wasn't until my heart gave out that I truly attempted suicide and made a very significant attempt to end my life. I could manage my mind. I could fight my mind. I could overcome it. But when my heart said, there's nothing left to believe in, it's not true, it's not going to get better, that's where I finally broke. So I think in suicide prevention, we need to continue to bring in the heart of it all. I'm not saying there's not heart in the people who speak on the science side of it, the suicidology side of it, but there's certainly heart in the people that live the experience and have grown and have the real value and can sit there and tell you, no, that doesn't work at all. What the hell are you talking about? You know, like, this is what I like. This is what I, so that stuff needs to continue to come forward in suicide prevention. I think, like I had mentioned earlier, the pre-prevention stuff, and this is something I'm really starting to embrace heavily. I recently accepted a position with Growing Out of Darkness, a nonprofit where I'm the program director. And some of the things we're looking at is how do we get so far upstream that we really start to embrace full wellness, not mental health, not just nutrition and body and everything, but the entire package, everything around you, to realize that it is all one and one thing affects another and there's all these different aspects of life. I think that needs to continue to be pushed forward in a way that's very uncharacteristic and non-traditional of what we heard in the past. I don't even like to use the word wellness because I'm sick of hearing about it, right? We've heard about it. And I'll be honest, another word I can't stand is hope. Like, I'm done with it. It's not working. We've heard this forever. And I have another one that I take a big stand on, actually, is recovery. And I'm sure not everybody agrees with this, but my take on it, and this is kind of ties into the question of what more do we need and where do we want to go? I have this analogy I use in my talks of Michelangelo when he was asked how it is that he creates such beautiful lifelike sculptures. He said, "I saw the angel in the marble and I carved until I set him free." Mm-hmm. Michelangelo didn't look at this block of stone and think about how he was going to recover the sand and the minerals and the water and the pressure and the time and the trauma that it took up to make that stone. Instead, he looked at it and he saw something absolutely magnificent inside. Now, recovery to me implies that it, by its own definition, that something was okay and then it broke and we have to piece that back together. We need to work through this process of healing and getting it back together. For me personally, I can't look at my life or even my suicide attempt and think for a moment that I was broken, that I need to be repaired and I need to spend the rest of my life recovering and piecing it all back together. Instead, I'd rather look at it and say, call it trauma, call it whatever you want, but there is something magnificent inside. I never aimed, when I made a decision to move on with my life and embrace life and be who I wanted to be, I never aimed to recover, I aimed to become. I looked at everything that I was handed and all the attributes that made me up and the ingredients that laid out before me and said, if I want to become the best I can be, the greatest potential I've ever could ever reach for who I am as a human being, this is what I have to work with. I'm taking it and I'm going to own it and I'm fucking moving. I'm not stopping and thinking I'm broken. I'm not stopping to recover shit that means nothing to me. I'm not going to look at the fact that I had relationship and self-trust issues and confidence issues and all the shit trauma had left me with and say, how do I get through all this stuff? No, I'm not even taking that road. I don't want anything to do with it. It means nothing to me. I'm releasing it. I'm letting it go. And instead I'm embracing what I want to hold on to dear, the compassion and the love and the empathy and the understanding and the self-awareness. Like, holy shit, that's awesome. That's going to help me become. I'm not going to try to reverse the process of turning marble back into sand and minerals. I'm going to take that marble and make it a beautiful statue, find the angel inside it. That's where I think we need to really continue to push on mental health and mental wellness and look at it from a life attribute perspective is, okay, if these are the ingredients we're handed, if these are the circumstances, this is the stuff we've been through. In all circumstances, is it really necessary to recover, or is there a potential to use that to our advantage and become something that we weren't before that could potentially make us even more beautiful?
Right, to reveal.
Reveal, exactly. And that's the work I'm starting to do with Growing Out of Darkness, tying that in.
Cool. That's awesome. You know, again, as you're talking, my brain's just like swirling and all kinds of things are going through there. And, you know, you're not the first person that I've talked to about suicide who's tried to die by suicide. And, you know, it startles me, always shocks my system to think about how young, when people have shared their stories, how early in their life they first contemplated this. Yeah. And I don't think that a lot of people realize how soon it actually starts. You know, we think of it as teenage things and we think of it as adult things. And, you know, there is a large number of men at your age that, you know, finally, for, you know, their lack of hope, I said it. Oh, no, correct me. Their lack of belief. I like that, in themselves where they finally, you know, make that choice. But you know, things that we don't do is we don't talk to little kids about this, right? Out of fear, right? Probably also
it's always out of fear. Out of fear.
And imagine pre-prevention, intervening, you know, sooner, realizing that 6, 7, 8-year-olds think about dying. Right. And then, you know, when we talk about too, about resiliency, I'm totally problem solving right now. This is where I'm at. This is what I do. but you know, when you think about resiliency and they talk about, you know, your best chances are again, not the only option. So I want to keep saying this. It's not your only options, but your best shots are if you have, the common denominator is a secure, caring adult. Doesn't have to be your parent. Mm-hmm. You just need a secure, caring adult. Mm-hmm. And if you've got kids in houses, because we can't change, we can't go tell people how to parent their children, and we can't go into homes and we can't say, this is wrong, here's the right way, like that we can't do that. We have too much liberty. And also, who decides what's right and what's wrong, right? I mean, there's always going to be that debate, right? I mean, politically, you know, sociologically, and we already are a society of people conflicted by how we move in waves over what's right and what's wrong. And we kind of like ebb out. There is an essence to humanity. We get that. But you can't go in and identify a family. You can offer resources, but if they don't take them, what do? You just leave the kids to fend for themselves, right? And you can't do that. So figuring out, knowing that we can prevent so many deaths in this world with an intervention tailored towards providing that secure, caring adult for a child, and not pretend that they may not already be thinking about ending it all. You know, that could be powerful right there. If you could get in and interfere in the system, because then the next wave, I think that's the thing is like, right, like I'm going to do a little science here because I do love science. But the next wave of this major architecture of the brain that starts to happen at 11 through 25, if you get in before that happens and start to get in and start to maybe retool some of the neurons that are coming together that then just kind of amplify and go in so many different bad directions or, you know, very challenging directions, that could be very powerful. And, you know, but we aren't going to talk to a 7-year-old about, you know, how are you doing? Because the parents don't even know. I mean, sometimes parents don't see that. So how would you do that? Like, I guess that would be the question to, you know, sit there and noodle on is how do you provide suicide prevention to a first grader?
Yeah, that's a big one.
But that is a big one, right?
I agree with you completely. So we had several years ago, we had done a 30-minute documentary called A Voice at the Table. And it was about what I had spoken about earlier about bringing lived experience into suicide prevention. And we had this premiere in a town nearby. And before it started, people were openly speaking in an open forum about how age appropriate is this and what age should we have the cutoff. And I'm like, there's no, what are you talking about? This, first of all, it's using safe messaging. There's nothing inappropriate in here. So we're talking about life and death and suicide and emotion. And there should be no age in my mind. And I get pretty passionate about it. I'm like, at 8 years old, I wanted to die. Mm-hmm. If you're at 8 years old and you're thinking about life and death, you should certainly be able to talk about life and death. Like, why would you limit that at all? Mm-hmm. Right. And there's this incredible fear around if we speak about it, we're going to put the thought in someone's mind. And it's just, that's the uneducated, ridiculous side of it, where for so many years it was like that. And it is starting to change. I mean, I do want to give credit to the field. It's certainly changing. Lived experience is coming to the front. The fear of it is starting to dissipate in certain areas. I mean, there's a lot of parts in the United States that I've spoken at that are still, I mean, they're 100 years ago. They're 100 years behind on where we think about suicide prevention and things like that. You don't even talk about it as adults, let alone, you know, to children. And mm-hmm. yeah, so there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. But I deeply believe that we should talk about emotions. I mean, I have two girls right now, 10 and 7. And they, one of them really has a lot of emotional challenges, and not only even say challenges, they're challenges to her because she doesn't know how to manage them yet. Mm-hmm. She has big emotions. She thinks big. She's super sensitive. Mm-hmm. She's very compassionate. She picks up on everything. Mm-hmm. And like, I almost look at it, like I feel bad for her because she's struggling with it, but I almost look at it like, oh, wow, this could be awesome for her. If mm-hmm. she learns how to manage this and control mm-hmm. it and can use it to her advantage, like she could have a beautiful life. So mm-hmm. My wife and I spend a lot of time working with her and try to help her understand and navigate what she's feeling. But yes, suicide comes into play with that. And you bet I'm going to talk about it with her. Why would I ever put anything off limits to someone who potentially feels that already? And if she were to ever say, you know, I'm thinking about it, my goodness, I would have the floodgates would open for what I would speak to her about. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. They're all emotional. There's so much opportunity. Again, I'm a glass half full kind of a person too. And it's like, why not risk it? Right. Mm-hmm. Why not risk these conversations? Why not risk these types of, interventions with children at a younger age, especially if the school or somebody can identify that their home circumstances, seeing that, wow, there's a lot of poverty in this house. You know, I have parents that don't seem to be connected. I have a kid who shows up bruised. I have a kid that, seems really withdrawn. You know, I mean, kids, demonstrate their pains when they come to school. Bully, the kid who's the bully, is a kid who's being bullied,
Right.
And so if you were to then recognize that they could at 7, 8 years old be already thinking about it and to be able to like cut that circuiting off sooner than later, give them tools to understand and maybe even be able to, I mean, that's like you're going back in time, like you said, as far back as we can get, and to make up for, some things that are beyond our control that we can't help. But again, those secure, caring adults, are like a strong common denominator for people and making it and not making it. And even people, when I talk to the ones that sit here on the show with me and talk about how they know to overcome, can usually come back to somebody, right? Sometimes they don't, or sometimes you have to search, right? I've had to sit there and go, okay, who, and was it one person? Was it a couple of people? How much of this energy power cell was really all me? What did help, that kind of stuff. And it may be hard for some people that are like, I definitely had a teacher who gave a shit about me and watched mm-hmm. me through this. And that's what I remember, moving forward. Because not all parents are perfect. I mean,
right.
Present company included. but other adults can definitely kind of come in. And the outcome is that, they're, think of them not as just helping them as children, but the adults in the future. Like I think of my son all the time of like, I don't want him to be the 40-some-year-old man who just is overwhelmed. That's why my conversation with him this week was mind-blowing for me and so uplifting for me.
Yeah.
To go, oh my God, okay, tools are there, right?
Like, yeah.
And he was the same.
That's amazing,
like,
for him to acknowledge it.
He's a smart kid.
Yeah.
He's smart. Clearly. I like to look at him and sit there and go, yeah, that's your mom.
That's awesome.
Oh man. Well, so this has been almost 2 hours. And so for anybody listening to this, surprise, this might be one episode. This might be broken up into two episodes. I don't know what I'm going to do with this one at this point here, but I did not want to stop. I got the sense you didn't want to stop either.
Yeah.
So,
that's great.
So this is great. So what are you working on right now? I mean, you talked about the nonprofit that you're
part of. I've started up. So for my whole way through this, my work in suicide prevention, writing and all of that, I've been completely independent, and I've been approached by a few people to work with them and collaborate. And I've done a few things here and there, but I never wanted to jump ship, and I never really had come across anything that I felt was 100% me, where I could fully put myself. And it was always something that kind of like, that's, I don't fully agree with that part of it. You know, there's always something. So I like doing my own road. And then I spoke about a year and a half ago at a conference called Kevin's Song in Michigan. And another speaker there was this woman, Jenny Landon. And she was, for one of the first times ever, I saw her whole presentation. I was just like, wow, she, one of the few people, and I mean this respected, with anybody who speaks in mental health, but one of the few people I've seen who truly, truly speaks from a place of love. There is no fear. There's no concern. There's no worry. She's speaking from her heart in love and really doing everything she can to put that positive spin on things and try to bring that to light and bring in real wellness. And she and I had gone back and forth for a year or so, a year and a half, kind of like doing a couple things here and there. And then finally, I had seen her speak in New York sometime in January. And we could do this together. And she had been asking me for quite a while. So finally I said, yeah, let's do it. And she brought me on as the program director, and that's everything right now that I'm doing. There's not much that I do now independently. We do have that agreement. She has her own speaking. I have my own speaking, but collectively, through Growing Out of Darkness in a program called All That We Are, which is allthatweare.life. We're working on that right now. And we have several programs that kind of work through wellness all the way to losing someone to suicide or what happens after postvention and things like that we're working on. But that's an everyday occurrence to me. I'm literally living two careers right now. Mm-hmm. So it's growingoutofdarkness.org, and Jenny Landon and I are working very close together to try to get things going. Unfortunately, the COVID, we had in the first 2 weeks we agreed to work with one another and started talking with people. We had three talks lined up: Texas, New Hampshire, and Morocco. Morocco was going to be a great one. And then it all crashed out. All of them are canceled, with the exception of New Hampshire. But I don't think that one's actually going to happen because it's too soon. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So we'll see what actually comes of that. Maybe it's just a matter of doing a bunch of online stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's amazing. So, and I'll have the links to that in the podcast notes here. I'll also have links to your website where people can buy your book there as well. Mm-hmm. And then you were also in a documentary called The S Word. Yes. And so I was going to throw a link onto that for people that wanted to be able to watch that. And so are you, if they wanted to invite you to come and talk to a group or anything like that, is the best way to reach you through your website?
Yeah, thisishowitfeels.com. Okay. And I usually do that. I mean, I speak fairly regularly all over the world. I've been to Lithuania and did a 10-day tour across Lithuania speaking, which was absolutely amazing. Cool. Amazing. That's awesome. Yeah, to speak to people about mental health in a completely different culture, and that culture barrier does not exist in that realm. It's absolutely beautiful to experience. I mean, I'll take that with me forever and hope to do it again. So I do speak fairly regularly. So.
Cool. Awesome. Dude, this has been cool.
Awesome. Yeah, I agree.
Oh, man. No, and I appreciate everything that you do. I mean, you know, this is, it is heroic to push up from the bottom, keep glowing, and then reach back to grab people to come with you on this. Yeah. And so, you know, I admire you so much for everything that you've done, everything that you continue to do. Your time with me today, longer than normally when I'm sitting here talking to people. I look forward to doing this again with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, and the feeling is mutual for sure. Yeah. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquericone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quirconi, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.